the field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live.
HRRN Live.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome to all of you just joining us now on Sirius Channel 93. Mike Pena, Jude Feld with you on the Horse Racing Radio Network here in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and getting ready for yet another final furlong show. And this week, of course, every Wednesday, our Trainer Talk edition, and going to be a really good one here over the course of the next hour. Trainer Ron Moquette is going to kick things off from 6 to 6:30, and then Doug O'Neill, Kentucky Derby winning trainer, will be here to talk to us about his career and some of his highlights that he's experienced. We know one of them already, but can't wait to talk to Doug about some of his biggest moments.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Can't wait to get to Ron. I get to meet a new trainer today.
I know. Ron Moquette, the native of Fort Smith, Arkansas. Nice enough to be with us on Trainer Talk here this afternoon on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ron, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Ron, let's, as we typically do, we're going to start from the beginning, but I told a story earlier as we were doing our HRN Live coverage here prior to this show, that you were one of the first trainers I had the chance to meet when I was working in Horse ID at Keeneland, and one of the first trainers that really I got to work with a little bit more closely around the racetrack, and I paid you all kinds of compliments, my friend.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. We need that.
Well, you're like Mark Toothaker. You're a native of Arkansas. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, is it?
Well, I think there's more than just us, but I think that we're going to fly the flag when we can.
Well, take us through kind of the early days. Start from the beginning. And what was it about this sport that got you hooked? How did you come involved with racing?
Well, I grew up around a little track called Blue Ribbon Downs in Salisaw, Oklahoma. And quarter horse was the big thing there. And I fell in love with the racing and getting to watch, a lot of the All-American Derbies and that sort of stuff. And then one day I turned on TV and saw the Kentucky Derby. And a friend of mine that galloped racehorses at the track said, hey, you can come with us, and we're going to Oaklawn Park. And if you want to go up there and check it out. And I went to Oaklawn, and if anyone's never been, once you go there, it's going to stick with you. And getting to watch thoroughbred racing, from that point on, I wasn't interested in quarter horses. I wasn't interested in anything except getting to Oaklawn Park and eventually the bigger races in Kentucky and everywhere, because that was I was hooked. I don't know how to explain it, except I was just hooked.
How old were you when you first started going to Blue Ribbon?
Probably about, it was the first year of their pari-mutuel, so I'd say around 86. So I was, I'd probably say I was about 14.
You don't want to give away your age?
Yeah, well, I don't know what the rules were, but I'm 100% certain I wasn't supposed to be on the back side. They let me duck down behind the seat and got me in, and then, I'd blend in with the jockeys and the short people. So when I got a little taller, luckily I was of age.
Well, I think the statute of limitations has run out on that, so I think you're all right.
Yeah.
What was that first Kentucky Derby that you remember watching?
It was when Don Combs won, I believe. Of course, the Allie Shubin, Allie Dar, I was already into it then. And we'd play basketball, some of my friends growing up, and I loved every kind of sport. And we would play basketball, and I would be – Allie Shubin, he would be Allie Dar, whoever I was playing one-on-one with, or we'd have a match race. I don't know if you guys, a lot of the people from down here, we have match races, and you go out there on a Sunday and everybody matches their horses. And I remember everybody would call their horse one of the Derby horses. but I think the first one that really got me, and of course now I'm clouded with the fact that I went back and studied every bit of it because, like I said, I'm addicted. I think it was the year Don Combs won with Dust Commander.
And you talk about studying it. You went back and just watched replays, or how do you study it?
Oh, I don't know. I read everything. I'm the biggest fan there is. You know, I'm as excited about being on this show as I am about the fact that Doug O'Neill is going to be behind me. You know, I'm a fan of anybody that's been good at it. I'm lucky enough to live the dream. I got to sit next to Bob Holtus for years and Jimmy Garrute and, you know, lucky enough to share time with, you know, those guys. And I get to see Lynn Whiting, who won the Derby with Little E.T., and hang out with him and go to his crawfish boils. I mean, for a kid coming from where I'm from and it being such a big deal, this is a pretty neat life.
You still sound like you're starstruck.
I'm not. I mean, I want to beat them up. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I respect them because they've been where I want to be. But, you know, I always joke with them that the only thing I love more than giving them compliments and stuff is beating them. And it was a huge deal for me the first time I ran against Dwayne Lucas because he was the Flash. He was the man. And the first time I ran against him, I remember Howard Battle at Keeneland talked me into running in a race I didn't think I belonged, and Dwayne Lucas had one in there, and I ran second in the race, and Lucas was third, and you would have thought that I just won the Kentucky Derby. I mean, I beat a white bridle, and that was the biggest thing. That was the biggest event up to that point in my life.
Yeah, that's a fantastic story. Those guys, the Hall of Fame trainers that you come in contact with when you're a small trainer, they really have a tremendous influence on you, and there's certainly nothing to be embarrassed about being taken by them and listening to them. It's a great way for a young trainer to learn. The more relationships you can have with guys like that, the better off you are later on in life.
Yeah, you know, and luckily, you know, from the outside looking in, it doesn't probably appear this way, but there's a lot of really gracious, helpful people in this game. And whenever a guy from Fort Smith, Arkansas is coming up and you're not from Louisville, Kentucky, or you're not from New York or Florida, I needed some help getting stalls at Churchill Downs, and luckily Mr. Holt has helped. And I needed to know who the best feed man was to get the best deal on feed, and Dale Romans helped. And, you know, I was really taken aback of how the community of horse racing was helping somebody who didn't have any bloodlines or ties to the sport other than just the love and the passion of the game.
So you're from Fort Smith. You know the Udodge family?
Yeah, I don't. I know them, a few of them. I know Ronald, and I know that, you know, I literally grew up next probably 10 minutes from them. And they were huge, but more of into turf racing, and I was lucky enough to have Bam Bam and him be a good turf horse and stuff, but the turf has never really caught my eye that much, and I didn't get a full appreciation of what they did in the sport until I was already in it, involved, and they were already out of it, you know. I do get to see them at Oaklawn. They come every weekend, and they're still, you know, a few of them are in it as a supporter, and I think they really still love it, but I don't get to visit much with them.
Trainer Ron Moquette, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ron, your first job around the racetrack was doing what?
I would say now at a real racetrack, sanctioned racetrack, not at the bush tracks. Was with Bernie Flint. He's one of the coolest personalities you'll ever meet, and he was really cool. He liked me because I fought, and he really took me under his wing and helped me. And I was walking hots for him, and then quickly went to doing other things. You know, with Bernie, I realized that nothing is not your job. Do everything.
go back to something you just said a minute ago. A lot of people don't realize you were involved with, you mentioned your love of sports, and you can kind of hear your competitive, fiery nature when you talk about going up against the likes of Dwayne Lucas. But you had another career, so to speak, when you were doing the tough man fights. Talk about that.
Well, I'm competitive at anything. I want to see who wins when we eat first, you know. I mean, I did tough man fights. Originally, my family was kind of involved in boxing, and I was naturally a lighter fella, and I started trying to box, and I was, I guess the best way to say it is I wasn't very gifted at it. I won more than I lost, but I wasn't, you know, I was like running at the lesser tracks, if you want to, you know what I mean. And then I did tough man because it was immediate gratification and everybody was not as fit. And I thought I could go in there, if I could stay away from them a little bit, I'll get a paycheck. So that's what I did, and had a lot of fun and won some, and I wouldn't recommend anyone doing it, even if you're good. But it was fun, and it was something to you know, kind of give my competitive nature a little reprieve.
And Bernie liked that aspect that you were a boxer.
Oh yeah, Bernie. Yeah, Bernie's he's funny. He wanted to go watch me fight, and then he would want to coach me. And I mean,
did we lose him?
I think we lost him.
And we'll get Ron back on the line here, and we'll go ahead and get back to him. Maybe a bad cell phone connection, but yeah, a lot of people don't realize that he was a boxer, that he did that, and he used to joke around with me about that all the time at Keeneland, and he'd say, "Yeah, I wasn't very good at it. That's why I'm training horses now."
Well, that's a lot nicer job to have.
Yeah. We'll get him back on the line there. A connection issue, I guess, back there. He's down in Arkansas right now. He's at Oaklawn Park.
Yeah, getting ready for the meet.
Getting ready for their meet. And that's a place that he holds near and dear to his heart. You heard him talking about Blue Ribbon Downs and then going to Oaklawn. And
well, that's a great place to go if you're not a fan of turf racing, because there's no turf course there. So
yeah,
so it's all on the dirt. It's as American as apple pie.
I can't wait to hear a story about Bernie Flint and working with Bernie.
Yeah, Bernie just won a stakes race at Churchill Downs.
Bernie would be great to have on this show.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's a former police officer in New Orleans.
Right.
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 He'd be really good to have on Trainer Talk here eventually. We'll do that.
We might need a beep button.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so. We'll get Ron back on here momentarily. I think we actually have Ron back on the line. And Ron Moquette, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Ron, I think we lost you right after you talked about going into training with Bernie Flint.
Yeah. You'd think that we'd have better satellite or whatever they need to get the cell phones out here, but we don't yet.
Are you still at Oaklawn? Are you? You're at Oaklawn right now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we're just now setting our stable up at Oaklawn. I mean, there's about 400 horses here, and they're coming in every day, getting ready for the meet. So, me being from here, we kind of try to get here as quickly as we can and allow our horses to rest and acclimate and get ready for the meet.
When is opening day?
January 11th.
Okay.
And record purses, they got a lot of new people coming here, so I was joking around that, you know, Dale Romans, nobody invited him. We don't need him. But he showed up, and we're going to have Mike Maker and Al Stahl and all the people that when you look down the overnight and you see the name, you kind of wish they weren't in your race. So. But these guys are showing up. Helen Pitts, I heard you guys mention her, excellent horsewoman. There's a lot of new faces coming with the usual cast of characters, so it won't be easy.
How many head do you have down there?
I'll keep around 30.
Yeah.
I could probably get a little bigger, but I'm trying to be very selective. I know I can only cook for so many people and it tastes right, so I'm just trying to keep the flavor right,
you know? There you go.
Well, let's go back to Bernie for a minute and starting your career working with Bernie Flint. What was that like working with Bernie? Because we talked about him being quite a character in his own right.
Yeah, Bernie is. If people ever want to get in the record books. I mean, his records speak for themselves. I mean, but he's a loud, I don't know, gregarious, deep baritone, and very proud of it, kind of New Orleans accent, ex-cop from New Orleans. And, you know, he's very funny and very comical, and he don't mind having people laugh at him, but he says some off-the-wall stuff. But the main thing about him is he's a very good horseman. He could be telling a story about something he did when he was a cop and you know, chasing somebody over a fence or whatever, and a horse walked by, and he'd go, "You better check the cracked heels on that horse." You know, and you wouldn't think he even looked down the shed road. But he, you know, he didn't miss a thing. And his ability to claim horses and do something that they needed and prove them was something that I was really hoping that I could get close to and try to emulate. And that's what I, you know, I try to do, is try to get the most out of horses. But he's a funny, he's worth the price of admission if you ever get a chance to share a conversation with him.
Yeah, what's your favorite Bernie Flint story that you can tell on the air?
Well, there, you just narrowed it down. there's a bunch that I can't tell on the air. I'd say the best one is, I wanted to take him to breakfast. It was around Father's Day, and I took him to, he's got some boys, and he was going to spend the time with them. But I wanted to take him to breakfast, and it was on a Sunday, and we went to Cracker Barrel, and it was a long line, and Bernie don't do lines. And we got there. He has a phone. He doesn't have an inside voice. So it's after church, and anybody knows Bernie's colorful, you know, vocabulary, but it's after church, and we're in there with a lot of people that just finished church. And his assistant called and was telling him that one of the owners had said he didn't want to cut this horse to geld it. And Bernie was very upset about this, and he was normally loud, but now even more loud, and saying that, you know, that horse needs to breed like you do, and there's no way, and he's saying some things that could be taken very wrong by anybody, let alone a bunch of church people. And you know how they stack you in at that restaurant, you're right on top of each other, and I'm wanting to climb under the table because everyone's looking at him. And he goes, he finally goes, "Let me go. Moquette's got me in here with all these blue-haired blankety blanks." And I don't even know if I ate or if I ordered. But, and then he just went on. He's like, "What? What did I do?" Like, yeah, that's the good Bernie story.
That's a good one. Well, Mike said we should have Bernie on the show sometime. I said, we need one of those beep buttons where we can cut out every other word.
You'll definitely have to have it. I mean, maybe you can record it ahead of time.
That might be it, yeah.
But I promise you, it's worth it. I mean, I've, you know, Lucas, Van Berg, and, you know, there's some others out there, Cecil Burrell, you know, but there's some characters that need to be appreciated in this game, and he is definitely one of them.
Well, it's a good thing we're on Sirius, so if he does get a little out of line, it won't be too bad because they do Howard Stern.
Yeah, you're right. He's right there with him.
Ron, when did you branch out on your own and kind of split from Bernie?
91, 92, I think it was. I took a gentleman from Metairie, Louisiana, that moved to Van Buren, Arkansas, had horses with Bernie, and Bernie got mad at him and fired him, which was something I'd never seen, a trainer fire an owner. But Bernie fired him because he questioned him on something, and then he said, "Well, you'll want to learn." He says, "If you can do anything with this guy, you'll be doing good." And this guy was willing to invest money, and he was a, you know, a high maintenance sort of guy. And he gave me some horses, and that was my start. And we had a great time. It was hard to deal with him, but he taught me a lot about dealing with people. I wasn't good at it, and I had to have some patience with him. But the horses that he gave me were great, you know. And I'd say he was my first win, my first stakes win. He put me in the top 10 trainers standings for the first time. This one owner did. And then after that, it just took off, you know. And I'm still very appreciative of Mr. Meyer and Pepper Tree Farms for starting me out. As a matter of fact, I train for the Sun now, who's a lot easier to deal with.
Well, those tough clients, they kind of hone you when you first start. People are willing to give you a shot sometimes, but sometimes it's not the people that you wish would give you a shot. I always used to.
Well, yeah, I said when Overbrook called me, I would have probably took them over him or something at the time, but they hadn't been calling.
Yeah,
so I was like,
that's what I used to say to my wife. If Phipps calls, let me know, will you? Tell him I'll be right home.
Yeah, you know how it is. You know, you being a trainer, you know what? It's at the end of the day, they give you horses. They trusted you to do your very best, and they paid their bills. And, you know, if I joke around or whatever, never, ever do I lose respect for what they did. Because if they're being hard to handle, it's just like a horse. You got to figure out how to deal with them. And I learned that, and not all owners are going to be easy to deal with.
Well, Ron, you've had quite a bit of success over the course of your career. Look back on some of the horses that really stick out to you as being horses that put you up to that next level.
You know, Asher was probably one. Of course, Keith Gold was one of Stephen Foster. He was a good one. Bim Bam. I love that horse. He's just I don't know, his stallion stands for $700, and he made, you know, he's second in the Man of War, and we beat Giapponi, which was, you know, a high five to us. And, you know, Amy's Deeney this year, going in the Oaks. That's the first time I was ever doing any of that business. So, you know, I like horses that have heart and that overcome and that, you know, would I like to have a Curlin or a you know, a Uncle Mo? 100% yes, but I love the ones that try. Anything that goes out there and does above and beyond what its physical limitations or its pedigree says, that's the ones that make me fall. I guess my favorite's probably, other than, you know, the big dogs, was probably Humble Chris, an Arkansas bred that I won all the distance races with. I mean, he won a race by 25 and a half lengths. I claimed him for 5,000. And we finished, I think, fifth in the standings of the most wins in a year. And this is a horse that if you looked at him, he looked like a giraffe. I mean, he was just all heart.
Yeah, so those are the great ones. I think I really enjoy watching horses like that. Maybe don't have the pedigree, have horrible conformation or whatever, and they just go out there and do their thing. And it really sometimes makes you angry when you get a real pretty horse in that's, you know, just checks all the boxes as far as conformation and whatever, and then they don't have any desire. That's really disconcerting.
Oh yeah, the pedigree. That's whenever you look through there and you've got a horse that's not trying as well as it should or putting out the effort. You look up and you see its brother, you know, one this or that, and you're like, come on, man. You know, all I want you to do is try as hard as we are. You know, if you're healthy and sound, please try. And the ones that do that, you know, the filly I said, Asher, was a filly that we picked a bad year to be a two-year-old filly. We had a little filly named, and we'll go to the Breeders' Cup, we have Chalucky, Spain, Darling My Darling, let's see, and I know none of those won the race. So, I mean, Scratch Pad. I mean, it was like a who's who of really nice horses, Surfside. And this filly digs in and runs against those kind every time. And she was, you know, a filly that had a colic surgery as a weanling or as a yearling. And all she did was run with guts. It's funny. We always joked around that she ran against every heavy head there was and never backed down. She was nothing but guts, and yet that was the only thing you could find wrong with her, was that she had had some of her intestines removed as a baby.
Well, Ron, believe it or not, yeah. We only have about 2 minutes left here before we have to let you go and get to the commercial break before we segue into Doug O'Neill coming up here next. But we'll have a little fun with this last couple of minutes here. What would you consider to be your best and maybe even your worst training job?
Oh, okay, let's see. My worst has to be yet to come because we haven't made any mistakes yet.
Not a boy.
Let me see. No, my best was probably Asher. Whenever I got her, Zoe Cadman was even galloping her, and she. And just to summarize real quick, they couldn't get her to eat in the 2-year-old training cell, and everybody hated her. They applauded when she left the barn at the 2-year-old training cell, and we fed her by hand. Literally a handful every 20 minutes all day, just feeding her. And she ended up being a graded stakes winner and making a lot of money and being sold for a lot of money. So that's probably my best, is figuring out a way to get her to eat and perform the way she did. And my worst was probably not being able to talk my owner into scratching out of the apple blossom the year that Spain and Missouri and all of them were in it, and we was 50-1 when we could have been 3-2 in the race at five horse field at Hawthorne. So that's probably my worst job, is not being able to talk an owner out of a spot that was tough and into a spot that was easier.
Those pesky owners.
He's Ron Moquette.
We need them, and I appreciate them.
Ron, we appreciate you being here with us, my friend. We got to get to a break, but thank you so much. And if you want to learn more, you can go to ronmoquetteracing.com. Ron, thanks, buddy.
Thanks, guys.
Great
thank
stuff.
Thank you.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I can't wait to meet him in person now. I love that. I love listening to this kind of stuff.
And the beat goes on. Doug O'Neill, he's up next here on Trainer Talk. Stay tuned.
Imagine having 80 channels of live, full card, uninterrupted simulcast feeds delivered direct to your home television for just $50 a month. Choose from your favorite thoroughbred, harness, quarter horse, and greyhound tracks in North America and internationally. Call Dish Network at 1-888-677-5487 and ask for RTN, the Racetrack Television Network. RTN is the only place where you can see every race from every simulcast every day.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
Introducing the Wizards Betting Window, a new wagering product available exclusively at DRF.com. The Wizards Betting Window takes the work out of wagering by giving you easy-to-use wagering recommendations for every race in the card at top tracks around the country. Both longtime horse players and racing newcomers can benefit from using the Betting Window, which suggests not only win and place bets, but also exotics including exactas, trifectas, daily doubles, and dime superfectas. And what really sets this product apart is the Betting Window Final Edition. Just download the Betting Window while you do your handicapping in advance, and then receive an update 30 to 60 minutes before the first race post time. You'll get all the latest scratches, current track and weather conditions, and late equipment changes. The Betting Window Final Edition will be delivered right to your inbox, so you can receive it anywhere. So use the Wizards' best wagering strategies to help maximize your returns. Visit drf.com/wizbw to try it today. That's drf.com/wizbw for the Wizards' Betting Window.
Don't miss your chance to participate in the biggest handicapping event of the year, the Daily Racing Form NTRA National Handicapping Championship, presented by Sovereign Stable and Treasure Island Las Vegas. To be eligible, simply log on to nhctour.com and register for just $50. Compete in handicapping tournaments throughout the country and win your seat at the NHC to be held January 13, 2013, Treasure Island in Las Vegas, where one lucky player will win an estimated $1 million and an Eclipse Award as Handicapper of the Year. Visit nhctour.com to see a complete tournament schedule and register today.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Welcome back to our Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, our producer Lee Delapina, all with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and a great visit in the first half of the show with trainer Ron Moquette, and really looking forward to this upcoming half hour yet still to talk about here with trainer Doug O'Neill, and well, he needs no introduction. He's a Kentucky Derby winner. Doug,
that's right.
Welcome to the show.
Hello, Mike and Jude. How are you guys?
Great, great.
How are you?
I'm doing super, doing really good, and actually, it's a little cloudy and drizzly out here in Southern California, which is a little bit unusual, but I think we can bear through it.
How is post-Derby life?
You know, it's pretty sweet. It's pretty darn exciting because we actually have a couple this year that look like they could take us back there next year, so it's pretty darn exciting. And having gone there and had a good result, it definitely, I think, from me to the Hot Walkers, everyone on the team feels like, hey, we can do this now. So it's a great atmosphere right now.
They say it's very addicting. Once you go, you want to go back, and it also seems like once you go, you get more Derby-type horses. What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I think the first part of that, that energy that's in the air there, and you guys know it as well, it is just so incredible, and it's why we're all in the game. And so that energy is addicting, and how do you get back there? I mean, nowadays with ADWs, there's very few racing days that give you that kind of excitement. I guess Breeders' Cup kind of does, but I think the addicting part is just that exciting atmosphere that is so cool about that particular day. And as far as lucking into more horses after you have a good run there, I think part of it is owners willing to step up and buy you better athletes, but in my owner's defense, they were buying me some good athletes prior to that. But I almost think once you have a horse run good there, you train in a way that of confidence that that just can hopefully, this will be, I'll know more the first Sunday in May if this really holds true or not. But hopefully your confidence in yourself and training can get you there every year. Even maybe if you've got a just above average athlete, your knowledge of what it takes to get there can get you there.
Doug, you spent so many years just trying to get there, and then you reach the mountaintop, the pinnacle. You win the Kentucky Derby. You mentioned there's a couple of horses in the barn right now that might be able to bring you back there again in 2013. Will there be an element of disappointment if you don't get back there now because you want to get there so bad?
Well, that's a good question, Mike. Honestly, I think there would be. As silly as that sounds, I think we'd all be pretty bummed out if he's had enough for Golden Sense. And then we even have a couple outsiders, a horse like No More and a horse I've got for that racing league, for the Frank Stronach Racing League, a horse named Royal Barrister, I think has a lot of ability as well. So, I think we put some self high expectations on all of us at the barn that we'd be very disappointed if we weren't heading there. And then, of course, you got to stay injury-free. But if all four of those stayed injury-free, I'm hopeful at least one will make it into the gate on that day.
Well, we know what the current end of the story is for Doug O'Neill, at least to this point anyways, and hopefully there's more great stories ahead. But how did it all start for Doug O'Neill? How'd you get hooked on horse racing?
Wow, God, you know, as a little kid, my dad, rest in peace, Patrick, used to go to the track all the time. And, you know, I was born in Michigan, and back then, Hazel Park and Detroit Racecourse, you had to be 14 to get into the track, 14 or older. And so I'd hear all about the races. My dad always had the racing form and was very intrigued and would watch the whatever race they would show on national TV. But it wasn't until the first weekend when I was 10 that we moved to Southern California that, of course, our first family trip was to Santa Anita. And I was just in awe. I mean, this was prior to ADW, and I mean, there was like 40-some-odd thousand people there, and the colors and the pageantry and the beautiful horses and the amazing athletes of the jockeys and the trainers with their fedoras, and I was like, wow, you know, what is going on here? Now I know why my dad loved the sport. And I had a basketball coach who went to school with Jude. And I remember telling Coach Mike Amadei, I remember telling Mike Amadei my love for the sport. And he said, oh, hey, I went to school with the trainer, Jude Feld. And I said, get out of here. You know Jude Feld. And, I mean, it was, he is and was a celebrity to me at the time. And so fast forward about 7 or 8 years in my senior year when I just couldn't get out of school quick enough. I gathered up all the courage I had to call Jude and ask him if there was any way I could figure out a way to come to work for him. And the great guy Jude was, he said, well, can you find a place to stay in Del Mar? And I said, oh, of course, not knowing what I was talking about. And he said, well, Monday morning, get there at 4:30, 4:45, and he got a job. And I was like, whoa, I mean, you talk about just a lifetime opportunity. So that's kind of where it all started. And then there was a bunch of funny stories that that I lived through, not knowing the racing world and getting to know it and how much time it takes and how much passion it takes. But I've loved every minute of it.
What are some of those stories that really stand out to you?
Well, Jude, I know, has probably told the story a couple times, and it is so classic because, you know, Jude was one of the few barns that he had a lot of American-speaking guys at the barn there, and his one of his grooms and one of his and his assistant were both kids from the state of Washington, and so. About the third or fourth day there, you know, showing up at 4:30 and working until 11 and coming back for chores and you know, asking Scott and Dwayne, were the two guys that I befriended there, you know, what they were going to do that weekend. And they, you know, they thought I was joking. And they said, well, we're going to be here, you idiot. What do you mean? And I said, well, you're going to be here Saturday and Sunday too? And they said, oh yeah, this is 7 days a week, you know, and I had planned on, I thought it was 5 days a week and figured, I don't know, didn't really think about who would take care of the horses the other 2 days. but it was definitely, even to my dad, who just, you know, I had a brother graduated from University of Michigan. I had another brother that worked his way up General Telephone, you know, they're hardworking, successful guys. And my dad, anyone you would ask why he was alive about his kids, he would immediately talk about, you know, my son Doug works at the racetrack. he was just so proud that I had some affiliation with the racetrack. So I remember when I first went on my own, I had a filly who was tying up all the time, and Jack Van Berg was stabled right near me, and you know, I had goosebumps and was scared to really make eye contact with him because I was just so felt so inferior to this Hall of Fame trainer, and got talking to him or listening as he was talking to me, and he said, "Where are you from, son?" And I said, "Oh, well, originally Michigan, and then, you know, Santa Monica." And he said, "Ah, you look Michigan. I used to race there a lot in Michigan, and you look like you're a family. Looks like your family's from Hamtramck." I was like, "Not knowing, I moved when I was 10. I didn't know if Hamtramck was Beverly Hills or Compton." I thought, "Oh, great. Okay, cool." So I get home and I said, "Dad, you won't believe this, but I had about a 30-second conversation. It seemed like an hour, but 30-second conversation with Jack Van Berg." And my dad was like, "Get out of here. Really? What'd he say?" And I said, "Well, you know, he said I looked like I was from a family from Hamtramck, Michigan." He said, "Oh my God, son, that's where all the nut houses are in Michigan. He's calling you a crazy guy." I was like, "Oh, geez." there's so many great things, and I think Jude can agree to this. I think I was just so blessed to start off at a place where, you know, there was the Las Breras and the Whittinghams, and just, I mean, the old cliche, success leaves clues, just shutting up and watching these guys and you know, and being in Jude Shedro with the Michael Houses and the Tim Conway seniors coming through, and just it's amazing how many cool things go on a daily basis, and just feel very blessed to be part of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about racing is no matter where you're from, if it's Hamtramck or wherever, you get to meet people from all different walks of life. I mean, it's the only place where a guy from Mexico is taking care of a horse for the Crown Prince of Dubai, you know, and you get this synergy of all these cultures and all these people, and most people that work on the racetrack, I mean, 98% of them are great. They all have stories to tell. They're all willing to help one another. You know, it's just amazing. It's like a big family, really. And it's like a family that gets along for the most part. And I think that's one of the beauties of our game.
Well said. I agree. It's something that it's amazing when you see the guys who have a lot of money and they could do whatever they wanted to do, and they choose to spend the day at the races because that's so enjoyable. And I love seeing Jim Rome, who for years Jim used to kind of bash horse racing. I don't know if you guys remember this, but he used to on air bash horse racing all the time. It's not a sport, and those jockeys aren't athletes, they're just little guys, and those horses, you know, blah, blah, blah. And now this guy absolutely loves the game. And he talks about, aside from the birth of his kids, winning a Breeders' Cup race is the best moment of his life. And that's pretty telling when you got a guy like Jim Rome who's hung out with some cool people and has seen some pretty amazing sporting events, and he chalks the Breeders' Cup win for him as one of his top moments. So it's a great game.
Trainer Doug O'Neill, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Doug, when you look back over your career, you've been around a lot of really, really nice horses. Of course, I'll Have Another comes to mind, and Lava Man. What are some of the horses that are really going to stick out in your mind, and for what reason?
Well, probably a horse named Skyjack sticks out as a horse that really helped me kind of gain the confidence that I could walk by the Jack Van Bergs and say, "Good morning, Jack," and not have my head down like, "Oh, God, I hope he didn't say anything to me. God, I hope he doesn't ask me any questions because I'm going to fail." I think that particular horse really showed me a lot in the way he had we had to do like two knee surgeries on him. He had two colic surgeries, and I mean, it's just like he had so much adversity, and yet when you asked him to train, he gave you everything he had. When you asked him to run, he gave you everything he had, and he had very little pedigree. And I think he was the very first horse where I try not to be cocky, but I kind of was able to walk with my head high a little bit, my chest out a little bit, and like, okay, I was involved in his care, you know, getting through adversity and leading him over there and winning the Hollywood Gold Cup. So that was, I would give him the credit for me having some confidence in the world of racing.
Yeah, he was a really talented horse, a horse that he had speed and could carry it, and yeah. He was a lot of fun to watch. I had forgotten about him until you brought up his name, but of course I was paying attention because he was yours, but he was a cool horse. I remember him.
He was cool. You know, it's funny too, towards the end of his career, we ran him in a Long Acres Mile, it was still called Long Acres Mile, but it was up at Emerald, and the way we train him, I mean, we let him, you guys have seen us clip these horses around there. They clip around a pretty good clip. And he had gone like 45 days without a work. And didn't even dawn on me. I had been watching him rip around there every morning and was so happy with the way he was going. And so I had him entered, and they called me and they said, hey, Doug, you're going to need to breeze him tomorrow, which was like now 2 days for the race or day before the race. And I said, what? And I said, oh, yeah, you know, the rule is you got to work within 30 days. If you haven't run in over 30 days, you have to have at least one registered work. So that was one where I had to call one of the clockers. I won't mention any names, but I had to offer him a polo shirt from Emerald and a hat. I said, hey, do you remember about a week ago when I ripped him around and I called you to get a 3/8 time? And no, oh yeah, I kind of do now. Yeah, I'm an extra large. Sure, yeah, I do. And he and the son of a gun won, and so that was pretty cool. He didn't have any registered work for 45 days, other than just, you know, a good 6-7 furlongs of open gallops, and he was so he just did so much for my confidence and certain things that I thought made sense, he's a very cool horse.
Where does Lava Man rank in the equation here? I assume it's got to be pretty high.
Yeah, he's just, that was like, I don't know, that would be like, you know, Lakers landing Kobe Bryant. It's hard to take any credit for an athlete like that because they're just so gifted. He's Lava Man's kind of horse you could have tried to screw him up and you couldn't have. I mean, he's just so, so talented and just such a fighter. And he's actually if I would have had like a real green horseshoer, I probably would have been in trouble because that was his one issue, is he would have feet problems from time to time. And, you know, I could laugh about it and not worry about it because I had Jimmy Jimenez, you know, he was the one stressing over what kind of shoes he's going to put on him and all that stuff. And it just always worked out. And, yeah, he was just a great horse who got better with age and amazingly, you know, stayed sound for so long and so strong.
You have such a good team. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, I lucked into Leandro Mora. I mean, that's kind of my Lava Man of humans. That was a great, great claim. He was with Brian Mayberry for years, and when Brian passed away, he helped out Summer and Jeannie, and then when they moved on, he helped out Tim Pinfield, and when he moved on, I lucked into grabbing him, and I think he's been with, God, we've been together now like 8-9 years, something like that, and he leads the way. I mean, he doesn't gamble, which I wish I could say that, but you know,
don't
Leandro,
we all?
even when you're having a good run, you're losing 85% of the time, whatever it is, and I find the assistants that gamble a lot really kind of rips them up, where Leandro, he's upset. Obviously, we don't win, but it's not like a double whammy that he just lost his check on at the races. So he's an amazing horseman who gives it his all with every horse, and he's not betting on them, so he's not overly concerned if they get beat about his pay or about his bankroll. You know, he's more concerned about what kind of tweaks can we make to try to improve for the next race. So he's our head guy, and then from there we just got just so many amazing guys, and like Jude, I try to keep it really light around the barn. That's what I loved about working with Jude is you could hear his laugh from a shed row away, two shed rows away. And
he always had that laugh.
Oh, always. And it's just so welcoming. And it's the way Jude opened the door for me and Scott Sack and Dwayne and all these guys. I mean, Jude was just so giving that way that he was always giving people chances. And, you know, that I'll be forever in debt to you for that, Jude. And I'll never forget it. And it's something that I try so hard to do, but it's easier said than done. I mean, it's, God, I see some pimpled face kids come up to the barn and I try so hard, but it's, you know, guys who don't know much about the game, it's hard to, have the huevos to give them that chance. And Jude was great about it. And I try my best to do it whenever I can.
Well, it's so hard when you have a big stable like you have, you know, it's a major operation. I mean, I was small potatoes. I had, you know, 14, 16 horses, whatever. Sometimes as few as 8 or 12, but, you know, you can afford to do that because you're hands-on with the horses and you're hands-on with the help as well. But, when you have as many horses as you have and as many high powered ones and top clients and that type of thing, it's a lot more difficult to, you know, let somebody have a chance. And I'm sure, you know, there'll be a time or two when you can do it, but it's inadvisable really for somebody of your size, I think.
It makes me think of the very first time Paul Redham came to the barn. This is 6-7 years ago, whatever it was, and 5 years ago maybe. And I had a newer hot walker who was kind of supposedly seasoned but newer to our barn. And so I was playing this, you know, Dwayne Lucas type of, you know, showing off all his stock and, you know, bring out, you know, so-and-so, bring out so-and-so. And so about the third horse of Redham's, the guy brings out, he walks him about 5 steps, the horse rears up, gets away from him, runs loose. And, you know, it's like, I was like, Paul, be right back. I'm going to go catch him real quick and we'll be right back. But yeah, it does get into where, God, you're just so worried that screw-ups can happen at any time. But, I guess that you do worry of someone getting loose or something goofy happening to you know, a new guy. And I think your confidence, Jude, and people's abilities enable that not to happen. But probably my worry would push somebody over the edge if they were on the fence of letting one loose or not. So, but no, it's a great game, and like everything else, people just need a chance. And the one beauty of our game, if you give a guy who loves the game a chance, they will be the best employee you can have, as opposed to a guy who's a little bit sour, who's been doing it forever. You know, sometimes I would rather have a guy who's a little bit green but loves being there, kind of a gym rat, if you will. But you just got to really be careful.
Trainer Doug O'Neill, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on HRRN. Doug, I know you're very close with your brother Dennis as well. Talk about that relationship and what it's been like going down this road with him.
It's been great. Yeah, he you know, we fight like most brothers do, and you know, he's just kind of a self-taught eye, you know, for picking out horse flesh. I'm just so proud of him. And you know, I think part of what makes someone good at sales at those auctions is being able to turn everything off and just focus. And I have a hard time at that because I'm always like, hey, what's up? Hey, how you doing? Hey. And at those sales, you really can't do that. And Dennis, a lot of people think he's kind of a jerk, and I think he's kind of a jerk sometimes too. But part of his makeup, his programming is such that he's just in his own little world a lot, and that's okay. And once you get to know him, you don't take it personally. You just know that's him. And at those sales, it's such a gift if you can just tune out all the chirping that's all around at those things and really just hone in on strides and horses' mannerisms and their attitudes and their confidence or nervousness or whatever. So he's had his maybe social weaknesses has turned out to be an unbelievable strength at those sales, and it's been obviously a huge godsend. And I we argue all the time, but at the end of the day, I'm so blessed to have him, and I tell him I love him all the time. And his health is, knock on wood, great right now. So we're looking for hopefully some more years like this year.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, he's a cancer survivor, and he does some work with my brother once in a while. I know they've teamed up on some things, and I think that's kind of a fun story that our brothers have both gone on to do so well in the bloodstock business.
Huge. Oh God, your brother's been huge. Actually, I know there's been more than a few of the good ones we've had that Dennis has liked on video. He's called Bob. Bob's been there. Bob did the checkout and gave him the thumbs up, on a couple good ones, and thumbs down on some that none of us have ever heard of. Dennis respects the heck out of Bob, and Bob's kind of been behind the scenes of a couple of our, more than a couple, probably a few of our good ones, and thank you, Jude, and thank Bob.
Well, I think it's I take a lot of delight in the fact that the two brothers are working together.
It is cool. It's good. Got the Felton O'Neill Brothers Association.
Yeah.
Doug, about 3 minutes left here before we have to wrap this up, but let's take a look at the other side of trainer Doug O'Neill. You've mentioned or made reference to some sports references throughout the course of the interview here today. What does Doug O'Neill like to do when you're not at the racetrack in your spare time, so to speak?
Drink a lot of tequila.
You like that? That's a good hobby.
It's funny because it's our quote unquote our job, but I enjoy that so much. And usually by the time I get home, I like watching sports on TV. I like going to sporting events with my kids. My son especially, he likes. Now his attention span has gone from about 20 minutes to about an hour now at these sporting events. So. That's enjoyable. And
how old is he?
He's 10.
Okay.
He's 10.
What's
and then,
his favorite team?
His favorite team, because it's my favorite team, or any teams out of Michigan. Anything with a Detroit or anything with a Michigan in it, he's into that. But, other than that, just, God, enjoying life. I don't know. It just, there's always something to look forward to in this game. As long as the kids are healthy and I got a horse in the stable, I'm golden.
How did how'd your son handle the World Series this year?
I actually, he had a little rough time, what we all did, had a rough time with it. But thanks to Paul, he had a work associate who had season tickets for the Giants game. So they flew us up, and I love my wife, but she, like most wives, can be a little tough at times. So it was a last-minute thing, and I called Lynette, and I said, hey, I got some tickets to a World Series game. Do you mind if I take Daniel? Thinking she'd be like, oh, my God, it's incredible, of course. And she said, the only way you can take him is if you take Jaden, because Jaden's hanging out the house. And, oh, my God, geez, how am I going to call Redham and ask for another World Series ticket? And I did, and he got Jaden a ticket. So here was Daniel, his buddy, and I – and Dennis, and we flew up to San Francisco, and Tigers got beat, but that was an incredible experience, and one hopefully he'll remember, and he can tell his kids.
Well, Doug, it's been wonderful to spend some time with you tonight. Thank you so much for taking the time. You've been great to us for a long time, and we can't thank you enough. Love it.
Thanks a lot, you guys. Take care.
Yeah, I can't wait till the Preakness next year.
I'm in.
All right. Trainer Doug O'Neill on Trainer
Talk.
Take care,
you guys. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's it for us. For Lee Delapina, our producer, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penn, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.